I don't know how many people may have read the entirety of the Mahabharata, but it is out there in English translations. It's voluminous, let me tell you. It is the largest epic by far in any language. I bring it up because if you haven't read through canto after canto, you might not know that there is an occasion before the battle begins when Arjuna seeks the blessings of the goddess. And so I thought I might read to you the English translation of that. This actually occurs in Canto 23 of the Bhagavad Gita Parva. And of course, Sanjaya, the divine sage, is relating this. And he says, Sanjaya Uvacha, seeing Dhritarashtra's army approaching, ready for battle, Krishna says these words to Arjuna. The Holy One says, purifying yourself, O Arjuna, on the eve of the battle, recite the hymn to Durga to achieve the enemy's defeat. Thus addressed on the eve of battle by Krishna of fathomless intellect, Prithu's son Arjuna, alighting from his chariot, recites this hymn with folded hands. Arjuna says, I bow to you, O Mahayoginis, you who are Brahman, you who dwell in the forest of Mandara, free from decay and dissolution, O Kali, wife of Kapala, of a black and dusky hue, I bow to you. I submit to you, Mahakali, wife of Shiva, the destroyer of the universe, you who bestow blessings on your devotees. O exalted Durga, you who rescue us from danger, you who are blessed with every auspicious attribute which has sprung from the Khatas, you who deserve the most devoted worship, fierce one, giver of victory, victory's own self, you who bear a banner of peacock plumes decked with every ornament, bear a terrible spear, hold a sword and shield, you who are the younger sister of the Lord of Cowherds, O eldest, born amongst the Nanda cowherds, always fond of buffalo's blood, born in the race of Kushika, O Pitambara, you who, assuming the face of a wolf, have devoured asuras, I bow to you who take delight in battle. O Uma, Shakambari, you who are white in hue, you who are also black, you who slew the Asura Kaitaba, O tawny-eyed and many-eyed, you who have eyes the color of smoke, I venerate you. You are the Vedas, the Shrutis, and the highest virtue. You are auspicious to Brahmanas performing yajñas. O you who know the past, you who are ever present in the sacred shrines erected for you in the cities of Jambudvipa, I bow to you. You are the Brahma Vidya among sciences, and you are that slumber from which there is no waking. Mother of Skanda, who possesses the six noble qualities, Durga, you dwell in the remotest corners of the earth and are described as Swaha and Swadha, as Kala, as Kashta, and as Saraswati, as Savitri, the mother of the Vedas, and as the Vedanta. With inner soul cleansed, I praise you. Mahadevi, let me always be victorious on the battlefield. Always minister to me through your grace on the field of war. You dwell in remote regions where there is fear, in places of hardship, in the homes of your worshippers, and in Patala. You always vanquish the Danavas. You are the Mahanidra, the great sleep, the illusion, the modesty, and the beauty of all creatures. You are the twilight and the day. You are Savitri, and you are the mother. You are contentment. You are sustenance. And you are light. It is you who supports the sun and the moon and make them shine. You are the wealth of the prosperous. The siddhas and the charanas look upon you in dhyana. Sanjaya continues, understanding the depth of Arjuna's devotion, Durga, who is always graciously inclined towards mankind, appears in the sky. And in the presence of Krishna, the Devi says, you will swiftly defeat your enemies, O Pandava, invincible one. You have Narayana on your side. You cannot be vanquished, even by the Vajradhari Indra himself. The boon-granting goddess disappears. Having that boon from her, the son of Kunti now regards himself as already victorious and mounts his magnificent chariot. And then Krishna and Arjuna, seated on the same chariot, blow their celestial conchs. The man who recites this hymn, rising at dawn, does not fear yakshas, rakshasas, or pishachas. He can have no enemies. He does not fear snakes and any animal with fangs and teeth. Nor does he fear kings. He is certain to be victorious in all battles, and if bound, he is freed from his shackles. He is sure to overcome all obstacles, is free from thieves, ever victorious in battle, and has the blessings of Lakshmi Devi for eternity. In health and strength, he lives for 100 years. I know all this through the grace of Vyasa, imbued with great wisdom. However, your evil sons, all entangled out of ignorance in the snare of death, do not recognize them as Nara and Narayana. Here he is speaking to Dhritarashtra, the blind king, source in humanity of darkness, and who gave fatherhood to these 100 evil, dark-souled beings. Continue. Nor do they, ensnared by death, know that the hour of the end of this kingdom has arrived. Dwapayana and Narada, Kanva, and the sinless Rama have all warned your son, but he does not accept what they say. Where Dharma is, there lie glory and beauty. Where modesty is, prosperity and intelligence are to be found. And in righteousness, there is Krishna. And where Krishna is, there is victory. I apologize, I've had to slant this over to the side so that I can look and see it. I didn't mean to look askance at you. So you see, assured of victory, blessed by this array of goddesses, Arjuna cannot lose. He can only win. And so, we come to chapter 7 in Sri Aurobindo's essays on the Gita, the creed of the Aryan fighter, dealing with the Gita, chapter 2, shlokas 1 through 38, first seen in print on the 15th of February, 1917. The answer of the divine teacher to the first flood of Arjuna's passionate self-questioning, his shrinking from slaughter, his sense of sorrow and sin, his grieving for an empty and desolate life, his forecast of evil results of an evil deed, is a strongly worded rebuke. All this, it is replied, is confusion of mind and delusion, a weakness of the heart, an unmanliness, a fall from the virility of the fighter and the hero. Chapter 2, Shloka 3. Not this was fitting in the son of Pritha. Not thus should the champion and chief hope of a righteous cause abandon it in the hour of crisis and peril, or suffer the sudden amazement of his heart and senses, the clouding of his reason, and the downfall of his will to betray him into the casting away of his divine weapons and the refusal of his God-given work. This is not the way cherished and followed by the Aryan man. This mood came not from heaven, nor can it lead to heaven. And on earth, it is the forfeiting of the glory that waits upon strength and heroism and noble works. A shloka earlier, 2:2. Let him put from him this weak and self-indulgent pity. Let him rise and smite his enemies. The answer of a hero to a hero, shall we say, but not that which we should expect from a divine teacher, from whom we demand rather that he shall encourage always gentleness and saintliness and self-abnegation and the recoil from worldly aims and cessation from the ways of the world? The Gita expressly says that Arjuna has thus lapsed into unheroic weakness, his eyes full and distressed with tears, his heart overcome by depression and discouragement, because he is invaded by pity. Kripaya avishtam. Kripaya avishtam, which means to be possessed by pity. That's 2.1. Is this not then a divine weakness? Let me pause for a moment, by the way. Kripa is sometimes translated as grace, but it comes to us meaning to mourn, to grieve, to lament, to long for. And so it can then mean to feel another's passion as one's own. And that is, of course, compassion. Compassion isn't a friendly thing. It's to feel the suffering of another. So, kripaya avishtam, which is this engulfing experience that has overtaken Arjuna right here on the cusp of battle, this is the thing that Krishna first asks him to dispel, to put it away from him. But isn't this feeling of compassion itself divine? Is this not a divine weakness? Is not pity a divine emotion which should not thus be discouraged with harsh rebuke? Or are we, in face of a mere gospel of war and heroic action, a Nietzschean creed of power and high-browed strength, of Hebraic or old Teutonic hardness, which holds pity to be a weakness and thinks like the Norwegian hero who thanked God because he had given him a hard heart? But the teaching of the Gita springs from an Indian creed, and to the Indian mind, compassion has always figured as one of the largest elements of the divine nature. What is it that the Buddha offers but compassion? Karuna. Karuna, if you prefer. It comes from the same root. Kr, K with an R and a dot under the R. Kr. Kripa, pity that we saw earlier. Same thing, same root as karuna. But the Gita will not rest with this simple refusal. Sri Aurobindo continues, the teacher himself, enumerating in a later chapter, that would be 16, 1 through 3, the teacher himself enumerating in a later chapter the qualities of the godlike nature in man, places among them compassion to creatures, gentleness, freedom from wrath and from the desire to slay and do hurt, no less than fearlessness and high spirit and energy. And the term there, compassion to creatures, is not kripa, it is daya bhuteshu, which means sympathy for creatures. 16.2. Harshness and hardness and fierceness and a satisfaction in slaying enemies and amassing wealth and unjust enjoyments are asuric qualities. They come from the violent titanic nature which denies the divine in the world and the divine in man and worships desire only as its deity. It is not then from any such standpoint that the weakness of Arjuna merits rebuke. I think I need to back up for a moment. So this portion where the teacher enumerates the qualities of godlike nature, that's 16, 1 through 3. And then when he describes harshness and hardness and fierceness, etc., that's 16, 4 through 20. And where I brought into the discussion compassion to creatures, that's actually chapter 12, shloka 13. I don't know if you're following this closely or not, but I want to be careful with the notes if you want to go back. And there he is, by the way, saying that one should be friendly and compassionate. That's Maitra karna eva cha, which is a kind of nod to Buddhism, because both being a mitra, a friend to all beings, and showing compassion to all beings, that is the typical characteristic of Buddhism. To befriend all and to offer the means to cease suffering to all from compassion. So it isn't that the Gita is against it, because here it lists them among the virtues. It's just that it has to be in the right context. It has to be in the right place. It's for the right person at the right moment in their developing maturity. There, in chapter 12, right after that, I think it's right after, this virtuous person is described as ni-arahankara. In other words, without ego, without doing things from the sense of building one's self, to amount a career, to establish or maintain prestige, to defend oneself against all comers, to feel friendship with all, to admit their experience into yours, requires a dissolving of boundaries. One becomes commensurate with the whole. This is not impossible to Arjuna on the battlefield either, but he has to grow into it. His first step is to overcome the prevailing weakness of his despondency. So Sri Aurobindo carries us back to the Gita with that. Whence has come to thee this dejection, Kashmalam, this stain and darkness of the soul in the hour of difficulty and peril, asks Krishna of Arjuna. The question points to the real nature of Arjuna's deviation from his heroic qualities. There is a divine compassion which descends to us from on high, and for the man whose nature does not possess it, is not cast in its mold to pretend to be the superior man, the master man, or the superman, is a folly and an insolence. For he alone is the superman who most manifests the highest nature of the Godhead in humanity. This compassion observes with an eye of love and wisdom and calm strength the battle and the struggle, the strength and weakness of man, his virtues and sins, his joy and suffering, his knowledge and his ignorance, his wisdom and his folly, his aspiration and his failure. And it enters into it all to help and to heal. In the saint and philanthropist, it may cast itself into the mold of a plenitude of love or charity. In the thinker and hero, it assumes the largeness and the force of a helpful wisdom and strength. It is this compassion in the Aryan fighter, the soul of his chivalry, which will not break the bruised reed, but helps and protects the weak and the oppressed and the wounded and the fallen. But it is also the divine compassion that smites down the strong tyrant and the confident oppressor, not in wrath and with hatred, for these are not the high divine qualities. The wrath of God against the sinner, God's hatred of the wicked, are the fables of half-enlightened creeds, as much of fable as the eternal torture of the hells they have invented. But as the old Indian spirituality clearly saw, with as much love and compassion for the strong Titan erring by his strength and slain for his sins as for the sufferer and the oppressed who have to be saved from his violence and injustice. Huh. And we often find in Ramayana, which purports to be an earlier but is actually a later epic than the Mahabharata, that these rakshasas are often in their undoing, worshiping Rama and making obeisance to him even as he slays them, knowing that they're being released from a cursed existence by the divine himself. It is that act of violence, a blessing, a blow that relieves them of a curse. You remember Sri Aurobindo's great passage in Savitri, echoing the same thing. But such is not the compassion which actuates Arjuna in the rejection of his work and mission. Huh. Without quoting it in full, and the demons wept with joy. Relieve them of their burden. Fight the good fight. Be virtuous. Act from truth. Satyam eva jayate. The truth indeed wins. But such is not the compassion which actuates Arjuna in the rejection of his work and mission. That is not compassion, but an impotence full of a weak self-pity, a recoil from the mental suffering which his act must entail on himself. Quote, I see not what shall thrust from me the sorrow that dries up the senses. 2.8. And of all things, self-pity is among the most ignoble and un-Aryan of moods. Its pity for others is also a form of self-indulgence. It is the physical shrinking of the nerves from the act of slaughter, the egoistic, emotional shrinking of the heart from the destruction of the Dhritarashtrians because they are one's own people. And without them, life will be empty. Swabandhavan, Swajanam. 137. This pity is a weakness of the mind and senses, a weakness which may well be beneficial to men of a lower grade of development who have to be weak, because otherwise they will be hard and cruel, for they have to cure the harsher by the gentler forms of sensational egoism. They have to call in tamas, the devil principle, to help sattva, the principle of light, in quelling the strength and excess of their rajasic passions. Not only here in the field of action, but we often find this in the field of spirituality. Because we can't deal with rajas, with vitality as it is, we have to weaken it all by bringing sattva and its light, its equilibrium, and finding common cause with tamas, throwing upon the being a renunciation of life, the incapacity to deal with our passions, and push it away, push it all the way, and make this a sattvic tamasic approach to life, which kills life. So, this is not the way of the Aryan. And this is not the way of a conquering spirituality which will transform existence. No. It is not for us. But this way is not for the developed Aryan man who has to grow not by weakness, but by an ascension from strength to strength. Remember, the suggestion of what Arya means is the person who is noble, who is strong in flight, who soars, who rises beyond, who goes into the sovereign empyrean on his own wings. Arjuna is the divine man, the master man in the making, and as such he has been chosen by the gods and blessed by the goddesses, as we have seen. He has a work given to him. He has God beside him in his chariot. He has the heavenly bow Gandiva in his hand, which he has received from Agni. And what does it do? It sets everything afire. And what does he set afire? His act is not an act of destruction. It is Agni who is there. So it is an act of sacrificial offering. It is taking this and presenting it to the divine. I have done this work to you, and now I offer it. The bow releases one form to ascend, become its essence, and assume a greater form later. He has the heavenly bow Gandiva in his hand. He has the champions of unrighteousness, the opponents of the divine leading of the world in his front, standing before him. There they all are. And if we put them down, we abolish darkness largely. Not his is the right to determine what he shall do or not do according to his emotions and his passions, or to shrink from a necessary destruction by the claim of his egoistic heart and reason, or to decline his work because it will bring sorrow and emptiness to his life, or because its earthly result has no value to him in the absence of the thousands who must perish. You see, it's not just him. He stands for society and culture as a whole. He represents the greater all. He can't act from his egoism. From rajasic motivation or from tamasic motivation. All that is a weak falling from his higher nature. He has to see only the work that must be done. Kartavyam Karma, Chapter 3, Shloka 22. To hear only the divine command breathed through his warrior nature, to feel only for the world and the destiny of mankind, calling to him as its God-sent man, to assist its march and clear its path of the dark armies that beset it. Arjuna, in his reply to Krishna, admits the rebuke, even while he strives against and refuses the command. And if you like, well, look, today is the day in which we are celebrating all theistic religions, I guess. You know, this is Passover and Ramadan and Easter all at once, sort of. And if you remember, Moses, in his conversation with God, whose name we cannot say, in the desert, in the burning bush, refuses the injunction from God again and again. No, I don't like your advice. I won't take it. No, as if he can refuse. God has a devil of a time convincing Moses to act appropriately. So there is something base and resistant in the human ego that even when the divine breathes the sacred word to us, we find ways to step to the side and say, no, pass that way in your glory. I'll watch. I'll start that whole paragraph over. Arjuna, in his reply to Krishna, admits the rebuke even while he strives against and refuses the command. He is aware of his weakness and yet accepts subjection to it. It is poorness of spirit. Chapter 2, Shloka 7, he owns, that has smitten away from him his true heroic nature. His whole consciousness is bewildered in its view of right and wrong, and he accepts the divine friend as his teacher. But the emotional and intellectual props on which he had supported his sense of righteousness have been entirely cast down, and he cannot accept a command which seems to appeal only to his old standpoint and gives him no new basis for action. He attempts still to justify his refusal of the work and puts forward in its support the claim of his nervous and sensational being, which shrinks from the slaughter with its sequel of blood-stained enjoyments, the claim of his heart, which recoils from the sorrow and emptiness of life which will follow his act, the claim of his customary moral notions, which are appalled by the necessity of slaying his gurus, Bhishma and Drona, the claim of his reason, which sees no good but only evil results of the terrible and violent work assigned to him. So let's back up for a moment. The blood-stained enjoyments, Rudhira Pradigdhan, 2.5, Bhishma and Drona, 2, 4, and 5. We'll have to come back and explain who they are and how significant they are, especially Bhishma, in upcoming meetings. He is resolved, Arjuna is resolved, that on the old basis of thought and motive, he will not fight, and he awaits in silence the answer to objections that seem to him unanswerable. That's 2.9. It is these claims of Arjuna's egoistic being that Krishna sets out first to destroy in order to make place for the higher law, which shall transcend all egoistic motives of action. So you see, Buddha makes an individual decision to renounce his princehood and leave the coming throne and abandon kingdom and family and go off to search for his own salvation. Krishna does not offer Arjuna any such hope. He too is a kshatriya. But he must remain. He leads him step by step towards a realization which will encompass and then surpass the Buddhas. The answer of the teacher proceeds upon two different lines. First, a brief reply founded upon the highest ideas of the general Aryan culture in which Arjuna has been educated. Secondly, another and larger, founded on a more intimate knowledge, opening into deeper truths of our being, which is the real starting point of the teaching of the Gita. So that would be 2.11 and 2.38. The first answer relies on the philosophic and moral conceptions of the Vedantic philosophy and the social ideal of duty and honor which formed the ethical basis of Aryan society. Arjuna has sought to justify his refusal on ethical and rational grounds, but he is merely cloaked by words of apparent rationality, the revolt of his ignorant and unchastened emotions. He has spoken of the physical life and the death of the body as if these were the primary realities. But they have no such essential value to the sage and the thinker. The sorrow for the bodily death of his friends and kindred is a grief to which wisdom and the true knowledge of life lend no sanction. The enlightened man does not mourn either for the living or the dead, for he knows that suffering and death are merely incidents in the history of the soul. Chapter 2, verses 11 through 13. The soul, not the body, is the reality. All these kings of men for whose approaching death he mourns have lived before. They will live again in the human body. For as the soul passes physically through childhood and youth and age, so it passes on to the changing of the body. The calm and wise mind, the dhīra, the thinker, who looks upon life steadily and does not allow himself to be disturbed and blinded by his sensations and emotions, is not deceived by material appearances. He does not allow the clamor of his blood and his nerves and his heart to cloud his judgment or to contradict his knowledge. He looks beyond the apparent facts of the life of the body and senses to the real fact of his being, and rises beyond the emotional and physical desires of the ignorant nature to the true and only aim of the human existence. And to that aim, we will come next week. We'll place a bookmark there. And resume, I presume, on the 24th. Now, next Sunday when we meet, that's the 24th of April, the day when when Mira Rishar returned 24 April 1920 to the side of Sri Aurobindo and looked out over the Bay of Bengal with him and knew that the time had come. Not to announce it, not to offer a prevision, but to begin the work, to do it. So we're in the middle of the Gita, talking about the creed of the Aryan fighter. He who must take up the work, whether he wishes to or no, as Mother in Sri Aurobindo did also. Once they started, every moment was Kurukshetra. So, I suppose we can do both. We can entertain essays on the Gita next week and also speak about the deep significance of the 24th of April to us. We're large enough and we can spend a few extra minutes together that day. I know I'm keeping you a few extra minutes tonight, more than we've often done. Here's a section from Savitri, Book 2, the Book of the Traveler of the Worlds, Canto 10, Kingdoms and Godheads of the Little Mind. I think we'll begin on page 256, and you'll see why the passage is relevant somewhere towards the middle of it. in the bright kingdoms of the rising sun. All is a birth into a power of light. All here deformed guards there its happy shape. Here all is mixed and marred, there pure and whole. Yet each is a passing step, a moment's phase. Awake to a greater truth beyond her acts, the mediatrix sat and saw her works and felt the marvel in them and the force, but knew the power behind the face of time. She did the task, obeyed the knowledge given. Her deep heart yearned towards great ideal things, and from the light looked out to wider light. A brilliant hedge drawn round her narrowed her power. Faithful to her limited sphere, she toiled, but knew its highest, widest seeing was a half-search, its mightiest acts a passage or a stage. For not by reason was creation made, and not by reason can the truth be seen, which through the veils of thought, the screens of sense, hardly the spirit's vision can descry, dimmed by the imperfection of its means. The little mind is tied to little things. Its sense is but the spirit's outward touch, half waked in a world of dark inconscience. It feels out for its beings and its forms, like one left fumbling in the ignorant night. In this small mold of infant mind and sense, desire is a child heart's cry, crying for bliss. Our reason, only a toy's artificer, a rule maker in a strange stumbling game. But she, her dwarf aides, knew, whose confident sight a bounded prospect took for the far goal. The world she has made is an interim report of a traveler towards the half-found truth in things, moving twixt nescience and nescience. For nothing is known while aught remains concealed. The truth is known only when all is seen. Attracted by the all that is the one, she yearns towards a higher light than hers. Hid by her cults and creeds, she has glimpsed God's face. She knows she has but found a form, a robe, but ever she hopes to see him in her heart and feel the body of his reality. As yet, a mask is there and not a brow, although sometimes two hidden eyes appear. Reason cannot tear off that glimmering mask. Her efforts only make it glimmer more. In packets, she ties up the indivisible, finding her hands too small to hold vast truth. She breaks up knowledge into alien parts, or peers through cloud rack for a vanished sun. She sees, not understanding what she has seen, through the locked visages of finite things, the myriad aspects of infinity. One day, the face must burn out through the mask. Our ignorance is wisdom's chrysalis. Our error weds new knowledge on its way. Its darkness is a blackened knot of light. Thought dances hand in hand with nescience on the gray road that winds towards the sun. Even while her fingers fumble at the knots, which bind them to their strange companionship, into the moments of their married strife, sometimes break flashes of the enlightening fire. Even now, great thoughts are here that walk alone. Armed, they have come with the infallible word, in an investiture of intuitive light that is a sanction from the eyes of God. Announcers of a distant truth, they flame, arriving from the rim of eternity. A fire shall come out of the infinitudes. A greater gnosis shall regard the world, crossing out of some far omniscience, on lustrous seas from the still wrapped alone, to illumine the deep heart of self and things. A timeless knowledge it shall bring to mind, its aim to life, to ignorance its close. Namaste. Jai Ma.